Careful researchers always make sure that they can reproduce existing results before attempting something new. That was particularly important in this instance, as John at first didn't believe me when I told him about the problems with the running records method used in the CSSR. So he first demonstrated that he could reproduce the CSSR's figure ES.5 with his own dataset. Then he went on to do an analysis using the standard method of absolute records. Tallies of these absolute records do not have the structural decrease of the running records method. If the number of these records changes significantly over the period of observation, it is because of a trend in the temperatures themselves. Christie's analysis of absolute record warms and colds used the data from 725 U.S. stations beginning in 1895. That's about half the number of stations used in the CSSR analysis from 1930, because fewer stations have quality records extending back to that earlier date. Nevertheless, his results are compelling, as shown in Figure 5.5. The record highs clearly show the warm 1930s, but there is no significant trend over the 120 years of observations, or even since 1980, when human influences on the climate grew strongly. In contrast, the numbers of record daily cold temperatures decline over more than a century, with that trend accelerating after 1985. These two panels together show something that is completely contrary to common perception. The temperature extremes in the contiguous U.S. have become less common and somewhat milder since the late 19th century. Yet the executive summary of the CSSR prominently features the faulty ratio graph, our figure 5.1, with the legend, "Record warm daily temperatures are occurring more often." Even if you charitably argue that the authors forgot to add, "compared to record cold temperatures," there is no arguing that it is shockingly misleading, especially when taken along with the rest of the report's material on temperature extremes. When the graph appears again in Chapter 6 of the report, it is beside text that reads, "The number of record lows has been declining since the late 1970s, while the number of record highs has been rising." But by the CSSR's own definition, the number of record highs has been falling. How could a report that proclaims itself designed to be an authoritative assessment of the science of climate change so mischaracterize the data? After all, the CSSR was subject to multiple reviews, including one by an expert panel convened by the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine, NASEM. When I dug a bit further, I found that in fact the National Academies expert review panel had criticized the discussion of temperature extremes in a late draft of the CSSR. Here is the key finding 2 of Chapter 6 in that draft. Accompanying the rise is, sick, average temperatures. There have been, as is to be expected, increases in extreme temperature events in most parts of the United States. Since the early 1900s, the temperature of extremely cold days has increased throughout the contiguous United States, and the temperature of extremely warm days has increased across much of the West. In recent decades, intense cold waves have become less common, while intense heat waves have become more common. Extremely likely, very high confidence. The Academy's review panel, in the diplomatic language of an academic review, criticized that finding as follows. Further, it is difficult to understand how a statement that includes increases in extreme warmth can be associated with a high confidence or extremely likely statement, given that most of the graphics in this chapter show a decrease in extreme warmth in the historical record. This is, of course, the same inconsistency that had raised my own suspicions. The federal official then in charge of the CSSR, Michael Kupperberg, then executive director of the U.S. Global Change Research Program, responded to the Academy's review of Chapter 6 by noting, "Almost every recommendation from the NAS was incorporated in the final version, and a new figure was added on changes in record high and low temperatures." The new figure referred to is the final report's infamous ratio graph, figure ES.5, our figure 5.1. It seems unlikely that the Academy's panel ever saw that figure after it was added. They surely would have commented if they had, and I doubt it would have then survived a publication. The figure's problems were evidently not flagged, or were ignored, in the subsequent internal government reviews. So those are the reasons I have very high confidence in identifying and correcting a prominent misrepresentation of climate science in an official government report. This isn't picking at a nit. It really does matter. The false notion of more frequent U.S. high temperature records is likely to pollute subsequent assessment reports, which invariably cite prior reports. More generally, it matters for those who care about the quality of scientific input to societal decisions and the integrity of the processes by which it's generated. It should also matter to those who proclaim the unimpeachable authority of assessment reports. And it matters for media representations of climate science, which give voice to such misleading conclusions. The CSSR's failures on the subject of record temperatures might be due to incompetence, but I suspect otherwise. It would have been more natural for the report to have presented separately the numbers of record highs and record lows, instead of their ratio, which, as we've seen, is rather contrived. But that would have looked something like the declining curves in Figure 5.4, making it difficult to offer increasing temperature extremes as evidence of a broken climate. I would be delighted if someone could explain how this misleading analysis was in the service of informing rather than persuading. It's no surprise that the media breathlessly spreads the CSSR's disinformation about record temperatures. For example, in March 2019, the Associated Press published a widely syndicated article under the headline, "Heat Records Falling Twice as Often as Cold Ones, AP Finds." The reporters used data from 424 stations to extend the CSSR running records analysis back to 1920. Interestingly, the figure they show starts only in 1958, omitting more than one-third of the years they analyzed, 1920 to 1957, perhaps because, as Christie's analysis shows, the 1930s and 1940s would be inconvenient for their thesis. Nowhere in the AP article, except for the figure heading, do they mention that the numbers of both hot and cold records are declining. Incredibly, they even include a quote from a former Weather Channel meteorologist that's directly contradicted by their own figure. "You are getting more extremes. Your chances for getting more dangerous extremes are going up with time." In short, I would summarize the data on extreme temperatures with the following statement. It has far less headline potential than that from the CSSR quoted at the beginning of this chapter, but has the advantage of being correct. There have been some changes in temperature extremes across the contiguous United States. The annual number of high temperature records set shows no significant trend over the past century, nor over the past 40 years, but the annual number of record cold nights has declined since 1895, somewhat more rapidly in the past 30 years. Of course, temperatures getting milder in this way, fewer harsh winters and cold evenings, makes for a very different and less alarming story than torrid summers and blazing afternoons becoming more common. As it happens, the evidence of a rise in the coldest temperatures is perfectly consistent with a warming globe, just not a roasting one that lends itself to graphics of bursting thermometers. 6. Tempest Terrors. This era of deadly hurricanes was supposed to be temporary. Now it's getting worse. Forbes, October 7th, 2020. Like everyone else, I've heard some version of the above shouted by the media each time a hurricane strikes the U.S. The message is clear. Storms are becoming more common and more intense, and rising greenhouse gas emissions are going to make it all a lot worse. But the data and research literature are starkly at odds with this message. At the center of this confusion are the assessment reports, which present summary spin inconsistent with their own findings. This chapter will chase down the facts about climate and storms, teasing out the truth from the tempest, and demonstrating that hurricanes and tornadoes show no changes attributable to human influences. First, a little background. Technically, hurricane is the term for a tropical cyclone in the Atlantic or Eastern Pacific. These storms are called typhoons in the Western Pacific, and just cyclones in the Bay of Bengal and Northern Indian Ocean. I won't make those distinctions and will generally use the U.S. term hurricanes for all of them. Up to a few hundred miles in extent, these storm systems feature a low-pressure center, the eye, surrounded by a spiral arrangement, counterclockwise in the Northern Hemisphere, clockwise in the Southern Hemisphere, of thunderstorms and tornadoes producing heavy rain. The lower the eye pressure, the stronger the winds surrounding it. A hurricane has winds greater than 119 kilometers, 74 miles, per hour. If weaker, it's called a tropical storm, and, weaker still, a tropical depression. Hurricanes are categorized by intensity via the Saffir-Simpson scale, which runs from 1 to 5. Major storms, those in categories 3 to 5, have winds in excess of 179 kilometers, 111 miles, per hour. Hurricanes grow from tropical depressions, low-pressure areas, born over the oceans alongside the equator. They then move toward the poles, their precise path depending upon the regional winds. Most never make it to land. There are about 48 hurricanes each year across the globe. Two-thirds of them are in the northern hemisphere, where hurricane season is June through November, and one-third is in the south, where the season is November through May. In round numbers, about 60% are in the Pacific, 30% in the Indian Ocean, and 10% in the North Atlantic. They are very rare in the South Atlantic. Along with tracking the number of hurricanes each year in each category and location, scientists have developed other measures of storm activity. One is the accumulated cyclone energy, ACE, which combines the number of storms with their intensities, weighting each according to strength. Storms are weighted by the square of their wind velocity. Another measure is the power dissipation index, PDI, which is similar to ACE, but gives even greater weight to the most intense storms. Each storm is weighted by the cube, or third power, of its wind velocity. There are good records of hurricanes going back to the advent of satellite-based observations in 1966. Who hasn't seen awesome pictures of an eye surrounded by a circular cloud pattern? And while far from complete, aircraft observations extend back to about 1944. Before then, however, there are only records of those storms that made landfall, or, occasionally, reports from ships unlucky enough to have encountered one. Going back even further means relying on historical reports and various proxies. Paleotempestology is the wonderful name for that field of study. So to understand trends over more than 70 years, before the onset of significant human influences, we have to correct for imprecise and incomplete observations, unfortunately all too common across climate science. The low-pressure areas that become hurricanes arise from evaporation of water from a warm sea surface. That water then releases heat as it condenses high in the atmosphere. This is the same process that grows and sustains a hurricane once it's born. So you might expect to see a steady increase in hurricane activity as the sea surface has warmed. Unfortunately, it's not that simple, as can be seen in the long-term record of the annual number and accumulated cyclone energy of hurricanes in the North Atlantic, shown in Figure 6.1. The long-term swings of the Atlantic Multidecadal Oscillation, AMO, as discussed back in Chapter 4, affect the sea surface temperature in the region where hurricanes form, and so can enhance or suppress hurricane activity. Even with an obligingly warm ocean temperature, atmospheric conditions have to be just right for a hurricane to form. Figure 6.2 shows the variation of the power dissipation index, along with sea surface temperature. As you can see, strong hurricane activity closely tracks the sea surface temperature until about 2008, and then it doesn't. That's because there are a number of other environmental factors at play, including the amount of wind shear, variation of wind speed or direction with altitude, and the presence of dust from the Sahara, neither of which is well described by climate models. Of course, just because temperature isn't the only factor in hurricane formation, that needn't mean warming, whether natural or human-caused, hasn't had an effect. While advising a U.S. government agency in the summer of 2016, I had reason to look into whether human influences have made hurricanes worse in recent decades. I turned to the, then most recent, National Climate Assessment issued by the U.S. government, NCA 2014. Its key message 8 reads, "The intensity, frequency, and duration of North Atlantic hurricanes, as well as the frequency of the strongest, Category 4 and 5, hurricanes, have all increased since the early 1980s. The relative contributions of human and natural causes to these increases are still uncertain. Hurricane-associated storm intensity and rainfall rates are projected to increase as the climate continues to warm." The report backs up that statement with a graph reproduced in Figure 6.3, showing a seemingly alarming increase in the North Atlantic PDI, that is, the strongest hurricanes, beginning in 1981. While the decline after 2005 evident in Figure 6.2 is also visible here, the general upward trend is emphasized, so that to the non-expert eye, it looks like we're in trouble and headed for more. But since the graph began only in 1970, my scientist's curiosity kicked in, and I naturally wondered, how unusual is this trend? What happened in earlier years? Hurricanes were recorded well before then, and even if the data becomes increasingly uncertain deeper into the past, knowing what it shows could help us shed light on the trends of the present. For example, does the rise in recent decades have precedence when human influences were much smaller? And do those straight lines really portend what's going to happen in the future? If in nothing else, climate data is usually consistent in showing an awful lot of ups and downs. So I dug into the main research paper cited by the assessment. To my surprise, I found it stated quite explicitly that there are no significant trends beyond natural variability in hurricane frequency, intensity, rainfall, or storm surge flooding. This seemed directly at odds with the National Climate Assessment's alarming figure, so I went back and searched the NCA more thoroughly. On page 769, buried in the text of Appendix 3, I found this statement. There has been no significant trend in the global number of tropical cyclones, nor has any trend been identified in the number of U.S. landfalling hurricanes. Wow, I thought to myself. That's surprising and pretty important. How come this isn't up front as a key message? The absence of significant trends in hurricane data was hardly unknown to experts at the time the 2014 NCA was being prepared. The IPCC's fifth assessment report, AR5, available in late 2013, states clearly that there is low confidence in any long-term increase in hurricane activity. And a 2012 reconstruction of the PDI back to 1880 reinforces the conclusion that recent decades are nothing out of the ordinary, noting that there have been periods before 1949 that were relatively active compared to the post-1995 era of heightened activity. In other words, there have been times before human influences became significant that were at least as active as today. Whether because the AMO cycle is currently high, as seen back in Figure 6.1, or because of something else, hurricane activity has been higher since the mid-90s than it was in the 1970s. But when the record of recent decades is placed in historical context, the trend in the PDI highlighted in the 2014 National Climate Assessment isn't particularly surprising. Figure 6.4 shows the power dissipation index in the North Atlantic for each year from 1949 to 2019. The heavy straight line shows the trend that NCA 2014 featured so prominently. Given the large year-to-year variations in the data, one could plausibly draw a line from 1960 to 1985 with a comparably rapid negative trend. In other words, NCA 2014 failed to include data from earlier years that makes the highlighted trend seem much less significant. The subsequent National Climate Assessment, issued in 2017 as the Climate Science Special Report, CSSR, continued the practice of burying the lead on hurricanes. Key finding 1 of its Chapter 9 reads, "Human activities have contributed substantially to observed ocean atmosphere variability in the Atlantic Ocean, medium confidence, and these changes have contributed to the observed upward trend in North Atlantic hurricane activity since the 1970s, medium confidence." That's a pretty weak statement for a key finding. Medium confidence that human activities contributed to variability, by how much? Followed in turn by medium confidence that the variability contributed to an observed upward trend, by how much? Even so, it is a good deal stronger than you might expect given the supporting text on the subject, found in the CSSR section 9.2. There is still low confidence that any reported long-term, multi-decadal to centennial, increases in TC, tropical cyclone, activity are robust, after accounting for past changes in observing capabilities. This is not meant to imply that no such increases have occurred, but rather that the data are not of a high enough quality to determine this with much confidence. Furthermore, it has been argued that within the period of highest data quality, since around 1980, the globally observed changes in the environment would not necessarily support a detectable trend in tropical cyclone intensity. That is, the trend signal has not yet had time to rise above the background variability of natural processes. Wow! Let's step back for a second to let that last part sink in. the globally observed changes would not necessarily support a detectable trend. The trend signal has not yet had time to rise above the background variability of natural processes. If we can't have confidence that a durable trend exists, we certainly can't confidently attribute one to human influences. The National Academy's review of the CSSR doubled down on bearing the lead. On its page 38 is a recommendation that the CSSR emphasize the recent upward trend in PDI, a phenomenon that we saw in Figure 6.4 is not unusual, even if its origins are not understood. The discussion of hurricanes in the 2017 CSSR is a profound violation of Feynman's Wesson oil caution, that a scientist must try to give all of the information to help others to judge the value of your contribution, not just the information that leads to judgment in one particular direction or another. Recent research only reinforces the lack of news about tropical cyclones. A landmark paper in 2019, co-authored by 11 tropical cyclone experts, was unusual for presenting the diversity of expert opinion. Those authors found that the strongest case for any detectable change in tropical cyclone activity was a very slow northward shift of the average track of storms in the northwest Pacific, 0.19 degrees plus or minus 0.125 degrees latitude per decade over the past 70 years, a 1.5 sigma result. Moreover, even for that slow, small change, 21 kilometers or 13 miles per decade, 8 of the 11 authors had only low to medium confidence. Most significantly, the majority of the authors had only low confidence that any other observed tropical cyclone changes were beyond what could be attributed to natural variability. I've been unable to find any media coverage, or even a press release, of that paper. Instead, the media continues to promulgate unsupported alarm. For example, to herald the publication of a different study, USA Today used the headline, "Global Warming is Making Hurricanes Stronger, Study Says." In that study, the researchers used a new method to analyze satellite imagery of tropical cyclones to determine storm intensity. They found a short-term trend toward more intense storms in the North Atlantic Basin and linked it to a multi-decadal variability that complicates detection because the climate drivers of that variability are not fully understood. Their bottom line conclusion reads, "Ultimately, there are many factors that contribute to the characteristics and observed changes in TC intensity, and this work makes no attempt to formally disentangle all of these factors. In particular, the significant trends identified in this empirical study do not constitute a traditional formal detection and cannot precisely quantify the contribution from anthropogenic factors." Yet the second sentence of the USA Today article says unequivocally, "Human-caused global warming has strengthened the wind speeds of hurricanes, typhoons, and cyclones around the globe." This is more than the imprecision that is so often a hallmark of climate reporting. The fact is that, while it is not unreasonable to think that warming might indeed lead to some kind of change in hurricane activity at some point, right now there simply isn't evidence that this is happening. Yes, economic damages from hurricanes are increasing, but that's because there are more people and more valuable infrastructure near the coasts, not because storm characteristics are changing long-term. And while it is possible that storms might get worse in the future, an assessment of model-based storm projections under 2 degrees Celsius, 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, of human-caused warming shows changes that can hardly be characterized as catastrophic, medium to high confidence in a 10 to 20% increase in many, but not all, measures of storm activity. Whatever the future holds, the descriptions of hurricane data in the assessment reports mislead by omission. They violate Einstein's famous dictum prominently displayed on the National Academy's building in Washington, D.C. "The right to search for truth implies also a duty. One must not conceal any part of what one has recognized to be true." As for the media, pointing to hurricanes as an example of the ravages of human-caused climate change is at best unconvincing, and at worst, plainly dishonest. Of course, hurricanes aren't the only storms that wreak havoc and garner headlines. Although tornadoes occur all over the globe, the United States has the greatest number of twisters of any country. U.S. tornadoes are most frequent in the spring, along a swath called Tornado Alley that extends from North Texas up to South Dakota. Tornadoes appear unpredictably and travel along a seemingly random track for an average of 8 kilometers, 5 miles. They're highly localized, typically 160 meters or 500 feet across, although some can be several times larger. But along that slender path, the damage they cause is severe. After lightning strikes, they are perhaps the most personal of extreme weather events. It's natural to ask whether tornadoes have changed in response to changes in climate, and to wonder how they might change in the future as human influences on the climate grow. For a scientist, answering these questions begins with a look at the data. Figure 6.5 shows the annual number of tornadoes in the U.S. It certainly doesn't look like good news. In the past two decades, tornadoes have been more than twice as frequent as they were in the 20 years after 1950, the change occurring over a period when the globe warmed notably. But this is a perfect illustration of the perils of correlation. A quick Google search reveals that both the number of fishing boats and the amount of movie violence are also among the things that have doubled since 1950, and certainly neither of these trends are due to changes in climate. In the case of tornadoes, the key to this trend lies in understanding how the data is compiled, which is often just as important as the data itself. So how are tornadoes counted? Today, weather radar can detect even very weak tornadoes from distances of more than 160 kilometers, 100 miles. Before radar was widely deployed, however, weak tornadoes didn't always make it into the record. While strong tornadoes leave an evident trail of destruction, weaker tornadoes can come and go without a trace, particularly in sparsely populated areas. To see if there's been a real change in the number of tornadoes over the past 70 years, we've got to correct for the observing bias in favor of strong storms early in the record. Tornado strength is measured according to the Enhanced Fujita Scale. The original Fujita Scale was developed in 1971, with the enhanced version adopted in 2007. Strength categories range from EF0 for the very weakest storms to EF5 for those with winds above 260 miles per hour. In the U.S. today, 60% of recorded tornadoes are category EF0, while back in 1950, such storms made up only about 20% of the recorded total. This suggests that the growth in the number of recorded tornadoes is due to counting more weak storms in recent decades, which according to NOAA is, in fact, the case. We can correct for the past observation bias against counting weak storms by looking only at storms in category EF1 and stronger, those most likely to cause destruction. This gives us the two graphs in Figure 6.6. The upper graph, an annual count of U.S. tornadoes strength EF1 or greater, shows no trend over the past 60 years, although there is a hint of a 40-year cycle. The lower graph looks at only the strongest tornadoes, EF3 or above, and shows that their number decreased by about 40% during the 60 years following 1954. In other words, as human influences have grown since the middle of the 20th century, the number of significant tornadoes hasn't changed much at all, but the strongest storms have become less frequent. Even as the total number has declined, there's been a shift in tornadoes away from the central and southern Great Plains and toward the Midwest and Southeast. Trends in other tornado properties are less certain. As the CSSR notes, there has been more variability in tornado occurrence in recent decades. Tornadoes appear on fewer days per year, and there seem to be more days when multiple storms appear. That's shown in Figure 6.7, which plots annual tornado activity in the United States from 1955 to 2013. The natural or human causes of the changes over the past decades remain a mystery. Tornadoes themselves are hard to predict. We know they are formed by thunderstorms, but not every thunderstorm spawns tornadoes, even if the storm's temperature and humidity profiles, wind shear, and spin are favorable. However, we can confidently attribute one dramatic tornado-related change primarily to human actions, though not in the way that usually comes to mind. Annual U.S. deaths from tornadoes have fallen by more than a factor of 10 since 1875, currently about 0.02 per 100,000 people, largely due to improved radar warnings. As for how tornadoes might change in the future, our discussion of both climate models and the factors involved in creating tornadoes makes it clear that predicting this is an uncertain business indeed. Yet unsurprisingly, the media cannot help at least implying that things are going to get worse. For example, the New York Times quotes a Stanford climate scientist as saying, We do have strong evidence that at the large scale, that global warming is likely to increase the atmospheric environments that create the kind of severe thunderstorm that produces tornadoes. It's just that we can't distinguish the signal from the noise. At the same time, the IPCC's 2018 Special Report on Extreme Events states in the executive summary of its Chapter 3, there is low confidence in projections of small-scale phenomena such as tornadoes, because competing physical processes may affect future trends, and because climate models do not simulate such phenomena. Any credible projection of future changes in tornado properties would have to be able to explain the historical trends, for example, the fall in the number of the strongest twisters. To my knowledge, that hasn't yet happened. So the best we can say is that, if anything, U.S. tornadoes have become more benign as the globe has warmed over the past 75 years, and we have no credible method for projecting future changes. Unfortunately, that last is not an unusual situation in climate science. Remember that next time you hear someone, whether a scientist or a weather presenter or a politician, proclaim that humans are making our storms stormier and our weather worse. 7. Precipitation perils, from floods to fires. When I joined the Obama administration in May 2009, my wife and I moved to Chevy Chase, a Maryland suburb just north of Washington, D.C. The lovely spring of that year, the not-so-lovely summer, and the pleasant fall gave way to the snowiest winter ever recorded in the capital area. The largest storm, dubbed Snowmageddon by the local media, dumped 28 inches over 2 days. On two separate occasions, unable to shovel our way out the front door, we were trapped in our house for several days with no electricity and no heat save for that most ancient of energy sources, wood in the fireplace. The federal government shut down for days as well. As is the custom these days whenever weather surprises us, the term climate change was bandied about in describing the event. While some asserted that our changing climate had clearly played a role, others, particularly those who insist that any evidence of human-caused climate change is part of a hoax, touted Snowmageddon as proof that the globe could not be warming after all. Psychology researchers at Columbia University have found that our views of changes in the climate are influenced by the weather in a fairly simplistic way. When we think it's warmer than usual, we're more likely to be concerned about a warming climate, and vice versa, despite the fundamental fact that, as we've seen throughout this book, weather and climate are not at all the same thing. The relationships between the two are complicated, especially for weather phenomena related to precipitation, otherwise known as rain and snow. For example, though it may seem counterintuitive, rising temperatures can indeed lead to more snow. For instance, if a rise in low temperatures keeps the Arctic Ocean from freezing in winter, more water will evaporate into the atmosphere. Since climate is a statistical concept over decades, no individual weather event can ever be firmly attributed to human influences, but it's certainly possible that human influences made Snowmageddon, well, snowier. Yet such a statement, as always in science, is ultimately judged true or false by comparison with the data, in this case, long-term changes in the average weather. Luckily, it's easy to check long-term trends in the weather for almost any location in the developed world. Figure 7.1 shows annual snowfall totals in the Washington, D.C. area. The trend has been toward declining total snowfall, with about a 40% drop over the 130-year period covered, 1889 to 2018. But the 15-year trailing average shows ups and downs, and the year-to-year variation is even more dramatic. So just how unusual was Snowmageddon? We can judge that from a list of the snowiest and least snowy D.C. winters. The Snowmageddon winter of 2009 to 2010 was indeed the snowiest since 1888, as is evident in Figure 7.1. But the, barely, second snowiest winter was 1898 to 1899, more than a century before that, and well before human influences on the climate were significant. 7 of the 15 snowiest years, about half, occurred after 1950, which is what you'd expect if there were no significant trends. The 67 years from 1950 to 2017 are about half of the 130-year history. On the other hand, 5 of the 15 least snowy years occurred just in the 18 years after 2000, whereas if there were no trend, one would have expected, 18 times 15 divided by 130, or about 2. With no trend, there would be less than a 3% chance of finding 5 or more of the 15 least snowy winters during those years. So the record of extreme snowfalls agrees with what the trend of annual totals suggests. If anything, human influences are making DC less snowy, rather than more. Of course, 18 years is barely enough to say anything about climate, let alone changes in it. And DC is only one location on a much larger globe. To better judge possible changes in events related to precipitation, snowfall and rainfall, droughts and flooding, wildfires, we need to look at the bigger picture of precipitation as the globe has warmed during the past century. Are droughts becoming more or less severe? Are floods becoming more or less frequent? Are wildfires becoming more or less common? We'll turn to the data to answer these questions and look at what those answers suggest about trickier queries. For instance, what might happen in the future as human influences grow? The amount of water on the Earth is essentially fixed. Almost all of it, some 97%, is in the oceans, and almost all of the rest is on the land, in ice and snow, especially the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets, in lakes and rivers, and in groundwater. But as we saw in Chapter 2, the 1/100,000th of the Earth's water that resides in its atmosphere plays a central role in climate. Water vapor is the most important greenhouse gas, and clouds account for most of the Earth's albedo. The sun's energy moves water among these various reservoirs to form what's termed the hydrological cycle. The largest and most dynamic part of this cycle is the flow of water from the Earth's surface into the atmosphere. 85% of this flow comes from evaporation of the ocean, the other 15% from the land, much of it transpired by plants. That water remains aloft for an average of 10 days before condensing and falling back to the surface as rain or snow, 77% falling on the ocean and 23% on the land. Precipitation depends upon both how much water vapor is in the air and the air's temperature. Water vapor will condense into liquid or ice and fall out of the air when the temperature drops. That's why you can see your warm, moist breath on a cold day. For that reason, while the average annual precipitation over the globe is 980 millimeters, 38.6 inches, of water, that is, if every location on Earth received the same amount of precipitation every year, that's about what we'd all get, in practice it varies greatly with the weather, the season, and most importantly, location. Globally, rainfall is high right near the equator, where much of the evaporated water comes back down as the warm, moist air rises and cools, but low where dry air descends, creating the bands of deserts that flank the equator. The driest place on Earth is in South America, on the northern edge of the Chilean Atacama Desert. Arica, which averages 0.6 millimeters, 0.02 inches, of rain each year. The wettest is Mausinram, India, which averages 11,871 millimeters, 467 inches. All else being equal, the hydrological cycle is expected to intensify as the globe warms. That is, there will be more evaporation, and the warmer air will be able to carry more water, leading to more precipitation. Precipitation is also expected to become lumpier, with dry areas becoming drier and wet areas wetter with more periods of intense rainfall. This could lead to an increase in flooding in some areas, but since higher temperatures would also increase evaporation from land, droughts might also increase. There's little consensus among models about exactly how, where, and when these changes would play out. Unfortunately, not only are these expectations uncertain, but also it's hard to acquire and analyze data that would test them, even to answer a basic question like, how has average precipitation changed? Unlike temperature anomalies, precipitation can vary greatly over short times and distances. It can be raining somewhere, yet be perfectly dry 20, or even 2, miles away. That's because, as mentioned before, it involves a sudden change in the properties of water. Depending upon the temperature and the amount of water vapor, water will either condense and fall out, or it won't. So unlike with temperature, there is no easy way to combine precipitation data from scattered weather stations to get at the bigger picture. Nevertheless, a combination of ground and satellite observations can give us a long-term global picture, most accurately over land, where weather stations are most numerous. Figure 7.2 shows global precipitation anomalies, deviations from the average, over land have increased at an average rate of 0.2% per decade since 1901. But this isn't a very robust statement because of the high variability of precipitation, sparse data, and the smallness of the change. In fact, as you can see, a steady trend is a poor description of the data. As the IPCC's Fifth Assessment Report, AR5, of 2013 noted, confidence in precipitation change averaged over global land areas since 1901 is low prior to 1951 and medium afterwards. Averaged over the mid-latitude land areas of the Northern Hemisphere, precipitation has increased since 1901, medium confidence before, and high confidence after 1951. For other latitudes, area-averaged long-term positive or negative trends have low confidence. This quote makes plain that there's good evidence for a regional increase in precipitation over land in that part of the Northern Hemisphere that includes the U.S., Europe, and temperate Asia, especially since 1951, but a more global pattern simply isn't there. A paper published in 2018 reinforces that last conclusion by analyzing more than 33 years of high-quality satellite observations covering the globe between 60 degrees south and 60 degrees north, everywhere except the polar regions. There seems not to be any detectable and significant positive trends in the amount of global precipitation due to the now well-established increase in global temperature. While there are regional trends, there is no evidence of increase in precipitation at the global scale in response to the observed global warming. This doesn't accord with the notion that a warming globe will accelerate the hydrological cycle. More rain, more floods. To be certain, though, one would like data that covers the polar regions and spans more than 33 years. But what about those regional increases? Annual precipitation in the U.S. has gone up 0.6% per decade since the start of the 20th century, as shown in Figure 7.3. Average U.S. annual precipitation is 767 millimeters, or 30.21 inches. As you can see, though, a simple trend doesn't really describe the data here either. The overall change is small compared to the dramatic year-to-year fluctuations. What's more, as the 2017 CSSR notes, there are significant regional and seasonal differences in how precipitation has changed across the country. Since 1901, the Northeast, Midwest, and Great Plains have seen increases, while parts of the Southwest and Southeast have experienced decreases. In other words, U.S. precipitation has indeed risen a bit overall, but the fact that it varies over both years and location much more than the trend itself makes it hard to draw any solid conclusions about the relative roles of human influences and natural variability. One detectable change that has occurred in U.S. precipitation is that it has become lumpier over the past four decades. There are more episodes of intense rainfall, or episodes that account for an outsized portion of the annual total precipitation, as shown in Figure 7.4. The increase has been greatest in the Northeast and Upper Midwest, while it's much smaller in the West. AR5 notes, rather weakly, that something similar holds for the globe as a whole. It is likely that since 1951, there have been statistically significant increases in the number of heavy precipitation events, e.g. above the 95th percentile, in more regions than there have been statistically significant decreases, but there are strong regional and subregional variations in the trends. Another aspect of precipitation of particular importance to the climate system is snow cover, which enhances the land's albedo. It most obviously depends upon snowfall, but also upon temperature. Almost all, 98%, of the Earth's snow cover is on the land in the Northern Hemisphere. The amount shows a seasonal cycle, high in the winter and low in the summer. A key finding of the CSSR's Chapter 7 is that Northern Hemisphere's spring snow cover extent, North America maximum snow depth, snow water equivalent in the western United States, and extreme snowfall years in the southern and western United States have all declined, while extreme snowfall years in parts of the northern United States have increased. Medium confidence. Satellite observations of northern hemisphere snow cover have been ongoing since 1967. Figure 7.5 shows the data over 40 years. Indeed, as the CSSR notes, there is a pronounced decline in snow cover during the spring, and also to some extent in summer, as would be expected in a warming globe, especially one in which low temperatures are increasing, as discussed in Chapter 5, while snow cover during the fall and winter has been increasing modestly. Those contrasting seasonal trends combine to produce a more gradually changing annual snow cover, as shown in more detail in Figure 7.6. There appears to be a distinct drop of about 0.8 million square kilometers, 3% of the annual average of 25 million square kilometers, between relatively constant values before and after 1989. Declining snow cover is again consistent with a warming globe, though another factor might be dust and soot on the snow, which accelerates melting by absorbing more sunlight. However, a straight-line trend doesn't really describe the data, since there has been no change in the 10-year average during the 30 years since 1990, even as the globe has warmed 0.5 degrees Celsius, 0.9 degrees Fahrenheit. I'm surprised not to have seen that in the CSSR's key finding, or in fact, anywhere else in the report. Of course, it's the extremes associated with precipitation, floods and droughts, that land climate in the news. The modest changes in U.S. rainfall during the past century haven't changed the average incidence of floods. However, trends in flooding vary across the country, with some locations experiencing increases and some decreases, as seen in Figure 7.7, which shows location-specific changes in the size of flooding events in rivers and streams. As for changes in floods globally, AR5 expresses low confidence regarding the sign of trend in the magnitude and/or frequency of floods on a global scale. In other words, we don't know whether floods globally are increasing, decreasing, or doing nothing at all. The report offers a longer-term perspective in the conclusion of its Section 5.5. In summary, there is high confidence that past floods larger than those recorded since the 20th century have occurred during the past 500 years in Northern and Central Europe, Western Mediterranean region, and Eastern Asia. There is, however, medium confidence that in the Near East, India, and Central North America, modern large floods are comparable to or surpass historical floods in magnitude and/or frequency. Droughts are even more difficult to assess than floods, since they are not solely the result of precipitation, or rather the lack of it. Instead, droughts involve some combination of temperature, precipitation, surface runoff, and soil moisture. Human activities, such as irrigation that depletes groundwater or the overplowing of the U.S. Great Plains during the 1930s Dust Bowl, can also play a role. One common measure of drought is the Palmer Drought Severity Index, PDSI, which estimates dryness by combining readily available temperature and precipitation data. The PDSI for a location can range from minus 10, very dry, to plus 10, very wet, but most values fall in the range of minus 4 to plus 4. Although far from perfect, the PDSI has been reasonably successful at quantifying long-term drought. Figure 7.8 shows annual values of the PDSI from 1895 to 2015, averaged over the 48 contiguous U.S. states. While there have been brief regional variations across the country during that time, and the past 50 years have been slightly wetter than average, it's difficult to see much long-term change. The AR5 says pretty much the same thing for the globe as a whole, expressing, no doubt to the surprise of many, low confidence in a global-scale trend in drought or dryness since the middle of the 20th century. But drought is a serious issue for regions within the U.S., as it has been for millennia. You can see that in Figure 7.9, which charts droughts in the southwest United States over some 1,200 years. The record, derived mostly from tree ring data, shows many droughts that last for decades. Any before 1900 cannot have been due to human influence, and the so-called mega-droughts from 900 to 1300 AD are thought to be associated with the naturally warmer globe at that time. Models project that the Southwest will become steadily drier as the globe warms, but the data shown for the 20th century are well within the historical context, and, as the AR5 notes, the current impact of human influences seems weak in comparison with natural variability. A study published in 2020 confirms the notion that a leading cause of multi-year U.S. droughts over the past millennium has been internal variability of the atmosphere. The 2009 National Climate Assessment explicitly noted the large natural variability in Southwest droughts by including a graph of the Colorado River flow reconstructed back over 1,200 years. The accompanying text says, "These data reveal that some droughts in the past have been more severe and longer lasting than any experienced in the last 100 years. In 2014, the IPCC's AR5 was similarly straightforward in one of the summary statements for its Chapter 5. There is high confidence for droughts during the last millennium of greater magnitude and longer duration than than those observed since the beginning of the 20th century in many regions. That kind of long-term perspective makes it difficult to attribute recent droughts solely to human influences. But, oddly, it's entirely absent from the 2014 National Climate Assessment. The subsequent CSSR of 2017 doesn't offer any figure like our figures 7.9 and 7.10, but it does have half a page of text describing the past millennium. Alas, it then spends about twice as long discussing the then most recent 6-year California drought, which that state's governor had declared over 6 months before the CSSR was released. As you can see from figure 7.11, which shows the Palmer Drought Severity Index for California since 1901, that 6-year drought was at its worst during 2014. By 2019, coverage was of the wet winter. It is hard to justify a climate assessment analyzing any trend shorter than 10 years, even if that makes its conclusions less newsworthy. On longer timescales, the state has moved toward drought since 2000. It remains to be seen whether that will persist in the coming decades. Drought exacerbates wildfires, which garner more dire headlines than any other precipitation-related phenomenon. Media coverage of devastating fires around the world, most recently in Brazil, Australia, and California, portrays them as a horrendous consequence of a warming globe. They can indeed be horrendous. 2020 saw record-breaking fires on the west coast of the U.S. that destroyed millions of acres, incinerating homes and communities and tragically killing many people, while keeping thousands more trapped inside due to poor air quality. These fires spawned an outpouring of articles with titles like "Western Wildfires, an Unprecedented Climate Change-Fueled Event," experts say. And in fact, changes in climate do play a role in the frequency, location, and character of wildfires. But understanding that role, and the part humans play, and might play in the future, requires we dig deeper than headlines. Sophisticated satellite sensors first began monitoring wildfires globally in 1998. Unexpectedly, analysis of the images showed that the area burned annually declined by about 25% from 1998 to 2015. That's evident in Figure 7.12 from NASA, which shows the global area burned by fires each year from 2003 to 2015, with a straight line indicating the trend. Despite the very destructive wildfires in 2020, that year was among the least active globally since 2003. Researchers attribute this decline to human activities, specifically the expansion and intensification of agriculture. As populations have increased in fire-prone regions of Africa, South America, and Central Asia, grasslands and savannas have become more developed and converted into farmland. As a result, long-standing habits of burning grasslands to clear shrubs and land for cattle or other reasons have decreased, and instead of using fire, people increasingly use machines to clear crops. In other words, whatever influence a changing climate might have had on wildfires globally in recent decades, human factors unrelated to climate were dominant. But the satellite data also showed a significant increase in the intensity and reach of fires in the western United States. In fact, key finding 6 of the CSSR's Chapter 8 is: the incidence of large forest fires in the western United States and Alaska has increased since the early 1980s, high confidence, and is projected to further increase in those regions as the climate warms, with profound changes to certain ecosystems, medium confidence. There's a bit more detail in the report's section 8.3. State-level fire data over the 20th century indicates that area burned in the western United States decreased from 1916 to about 1940, was at low levels until the 1970s, then increased into the more recent period. Climate changes are surely playing a role here. Less rainfall and higher temperatures make for drier fuel that's easier to ignite and promotes a fire's rapid spread and intensification. The IPCC's SR15 report of 2018 makes that explicit in its Chapter 3. There is additional evidence for attribution of increased forest fire in North America to anthropogenic climate change during 1984 to 2015 via the mechanism of increasing fuel aridity, almost doubling the western U.S. forest fire area compared to what would have been expected in the absence of climate change. The 2016 study cited to support that statement compared dryness of fuel in climates with and without human influences as simulated by 27 CMIP5 models. Those differences in dryness then result in different fire properties. Of course, attributing all of the increase in fire area to human causes assumes that the models correctly reproduce internal variability, which they don't. That's particularly true because of the high longer-term variability of drought in the Southwest, as shown in Figure 7.9. But factors other than climate must also play an important, if not dominant, role, since fires declined in the early part of the 20th century, even as California's drought conditions showed no trend, as seen in Figure 7.11. Human influences can take many forms. Forest management, how much fuel is allowed to accumulate? Are fires suppressed or allowed to burn? How much development is permitted in or near forests? And human-caused ignition, nearly 85% of U.S. wildland fires have a human cause, are among the contributors. While we may not be able to fully quantify, much less control, the many climate-related influences on wildfires, we have significant power to address these human factors. By making the conversation about wildfires only one of unavoidable doom due to climate change, we miss an opportunity to take steps that would more directly curtail these catastrophes. Of course, things can, and surely will, change in coming decades. But how they will change is far from certain. We shouldn't place too much confidence in model projections of future changes in precipitation. After all, they come from the models discussed in Chapter 4. And as AR5 notes, the simulation of large-scale patterns of precipitation has improved somewhat since the AR4, although models continue to perform less well for precipitation than for surface temperature. In fact, it's even worse than that. The report states explicitly that, in general, the CMIP5 model ensembles cannot be taken as a reliable regional probability forecast for any aspect of the climate. In other words, the models are even worse at describing changes in regional climates than they are at describing changes in global quantities. Because droughts and floods have such dramatic impact, however, politicians and other officials can't resist citing model results to prophesy future catastrophes. Mark Carney, former head of Canada's Central Bank and later head of the Bank of England, is probably the single most influential figure in driving investors and financial institutions around the world to focus on changes in climate and human influences upon it. A learned man with a PhD in economics from Oxford University, he has been an outstanding central banker. Carney is now the United Nations Special Envoy on Climate Action and Finance. He is also a UK advisor for the 26th annual UN Conference of Parties, COP26, a follow-on to the 2015 Paris Climate Conference that's due to take place in Glasgow, Scotland, during November 2021. So it's important to pay close attention to what he says. In a 2015 speech just before the Paris Conference, speaking as Governor of the Bank of England, Carney laid out many aspects of the insurance response to climate change. Extreme weather costs insurance companies a lot of money, so perhaps it is no wonder that his appeal included a warning about flooding. Despite winter 2014 being England's wettest since the time of King George III, forecasts suggest we can expect at least a further 10% increase in rainfall during future winters. To support that assertion, he cited Britain's Met Office Research into Climate Observations, Projections, and Impacts. These were model forecasts for the next 5 years, so you might expect they'd be more accurate than those attempting to project climate 50 years out. Let's turn to the data and see. Figure 7.13 shows the observed winter precipitation, December through February, in England and Wales up through 2020. It's one of the longest instrumental weather series available, beginning in 1766. The average rainfall looks pretty constant over decades from 1780 to 1870, and again from 1920 to the present. A shift occurred somewhere over the 50 years in between, when human influences on the global climate were quite negligible. Carney was correct that 2014 was a record wet winter, 455.5 millimeters, or 17.9 inches, and it was indeed the wettest since the time of King George, since George III's reign lasted until 1820. But the Met Office models Carney cited back in 2014 all turned out to be dead wrong. Rainfall during the 6 winters after 2014 was well in context with the previous century, and it averaged 278 millimeters, 39% less than the 2014 record, and nowhere near the at least 500 millimeters implied by the predicted increase. And a Met Office analysis published in 2018 found that the largest source of variability in UK extreme rainfalls during the winter months was the North Atlantic oscillation mode of natural variability, not a changing climate. Of course, Carney could take refuge in his speech's subjunctive "forecasts suggest" and the indeterminate hedging of "future winters." Nevertheless, it's surprising that someone with a PhD in economics and experience with the unpredictability of financial markets and economies as a whole doesn't show a greater respect for the perils of prediction and more caution in depending upon models. Floods, droughts, and fires bring great tragedy and sorrow, and their consequences can be devastating. As the world gets more and more connected through communications, we become more and more aware of these events when they happen. But that does not make them further proof of climate change. In the end, the data tells us there's not very much changing very quickly with precipitation, either globally or in the U.S. And the uncertain models suggest that humanity's long frustration with precipitation's unpredictability isn't going anywhere anytime soon. 8. Sea level scares. A striking image of a half-submerged Statue of Liberty filled the cover of the September issue of National Geographic magazine in 2013, touting its lead story, "Rising Seas: How They Are Changing Our Coastlines." Any curious reader could have consulted the record of the tide gauge at the Battery at the tip of Manhattan, less than 2 miles from the statue, and seen that sea level there has been rising at an average rate of about 30 centimeters, 1 foot, per century since 1855. And a quick calculation would show that, at this rate, it would take more than 20,000 years for the water to reach the level shown menacing poor Lady Liberty. But along with demonstrating that those who design magazine covers know how to get our attention with nothing but Photoshop and a healthy serving of artistic license, the oldest surviving human structures